Hey there, everyone. Time to kick off another exciting session of Office Hours. Welcome to Cloud Posse's DevOps Office Hours on this fine 22nd day of March 2023. My name is Eric Osterman. I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse, and I'll be your host today. Cloud Posse is the DevOps accelerator you need. We empower companies to conquer AWS using our rock-solid Terraform blueprints, and we're so confident in our results, we offer a money-back guarantee. Whether you're starting from scratch or just not satisfied with your current setup, head to cloudposse.com/quiz to book a session with me, and I'll show you exactly what your future can look like, and it's amazing. If you're new here or not familiar with what Cloud Posse is doing, don't worry, our format is super informal. My main goal is to answer your questions. If you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, this is a great place to ask. For those of you joining us from our podcast or YouTube channel, you can register for these live and interactive sessions by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. To register. We host these calls every week, so don't miss out. And just a heads up, today's call is recorded. We'll automatically post a recording of this session to our YouTube channel. So if you want to support what we do over here, please hit those like and subscribe buttons. It helps us out a great deal. And don't forget, you can always share these videos with your team. It's a great way to keep everyone on the same page. So with that said, got a lot of exciting announcements for this week. This first one might not be that exciting, depending on, you know, if it affects you. But Node.js 12 is reaching end of life on the Lambda runtime. So if you haven't yet updated your apps, time to do so. Amazon Linux has received a refresh now. It looks like they've switched to at least annual versioning scheme of some sort here. Previous version was Amazon Linux 2. Now we jump to 2023. There's a breakdown of some of the highlights and what to expect as some differences. SE Linux is enabled in permissive mode by default, and IMDS v2 is enabled by default. So you definitely want to have this if you're running any EC2 instances to make it one step harder for your AWS credentials to get exfiltrated. Combine that with the announcement from last week, I think it is, where you can now restrict those IMDS v2 credentials to the host they originated on. That's really good. That said, Cloud Posse, we've been really happy with Bottle Rocket. We're using that as our go-to de facto image for all of our Kubernetes clusters with customers and had no problems with that. So I would say that's probably a better, more hardened approach than this, if you're using it for like server side. All right. Anything else to add on the Amazon Linux announcement? All right. The next one, I think it actually came out last week. We didn't announce it. I didn't see it. There's so many Lambda announcements. It's kind of just noise for me sometimes, but this was kind of cool, I thought. You can now attach a Lambda to requests of objects in S3 and modify those responses. Similar to what you could do in CloudFront. This is still nice because if you couple this with CloudFront, then you know, CloudFront can cache the output of that request. And it's just further pushing things out to the edge so you don't need to host it and operate it. Has anybody already looked at this?
I haven't, but I just want to be sure, like what you said, I think confused me a little bit, but I think you can only use this if you are using CloudFront, not just if you're using S3 natively, right? Isn't that what that says, the headline? Maybe I'm wrong.
That's what the headline says. That was my interpretation of the implementation, but it is where
you could already use it with S3. The thing was you couldn't use it with CloudFront, and now you can.
Well, you could use it with CloudFront if you did Lambda at edge, basically. You could do that kind of transformation before, but I guess this makes it simpler.
Okay. All right. Thanks for clearing that up. Another announcement on the Cloud Posse side. If you're using Atmos, which is our workflow automation tool, it really excels at complex enterprise scale configurations and things related to Terraform. We've always supported inheritance for a very long time, and we added multiple inheritance last year sometime. Now we've added multiple levels of multiple inheritance. So previously in our implementation of multiple inheritance, if you were inheriting another configuration and that configuration itself was inheriting other configurations, that didn't work. It didn't translate. So now we support any number of levels of nested inheritance within Atmos. The documentation has been updated. These are advanced concepts, of course, for managing configurations. So lots of diagrams explaining what these things mean, so you can follow and understand it and leverage it in your configurations. This is the main differentiator between Atmos and every other tool out there you're going to find for doing Terraform or similar things. It's how do you manage really large scale configurations, thousands of Terraform root modules, adding OPA policies on top of that, and so forth. All right, other exciting announcement is from Spacelift. This is something that we wanted for a long time. This adds a native integration between your Spacelift stacks and Datadog to send telemetry over there. So now you can start reporting on the stability of your stacks, alert team members when stacks are failing, and get a more holistic view of everything, obviously, if you're using Datadog under a single pane of glass. It opens up all kinds of reporting capabilities that you couldn't do, of course, because Spacelift doesn't have like a reporting UI, as most SaaS products don't. I think it's a nice advent. I think more SaaS products out there should natively have integrations with monitoring platforms like this, rather than try and build things in-house. Next announcement is another Cloud Posse announcement. If you've been using Geodesic, Geodesic is Cloud Posse's toolbox container. It's a base image you can use for DevOps, so to say. It ships with all the standard packages, tools of our trade, if you will. And we also have a package repository for RPMs and Debian packages, Alpine as well, but we're really moving on from Alpine at this point. So with this announcement, we have added ARM support after a long time and much support. There's still forthcoming things we need to do to improve this implementation, but it's usable at this stage and will radically speed up your usage of Geodesic on the desktop with Terraform and so forth. Feedback welcome. Please open up any issues if you have problems with it. Another thing that caught my attention was something on LinkedIn I saw. Amazon Samples, I'm not sure the relationship between Amazon AWS Samples, AWS Labs, AWS IA, and presumably, you know, a handful more AWS organizations, but is maintaining a utility to help inform you of the impact of doing any kinds of upgrades on EKS. I don't believe it actually helps you perform. Well, I guess, yeah. So it actually helps you perform the upgrade as well. I was looking more at the pre-flight checks. So this does a lot of the things that you get from other tools out there. Tools like, is it Pluto or something by OpsWorks? Fairwinds, I guess, is the company these days. Yeah. So I'm excited about this. Upgrading EKS clusters. we talked about this when 1.25 came out. Like, it used to be big news when Amazon announced EKS cluster upgrades because they were lagging far behind Kubernetes version updates. Now they're pretty much right on par with Kubernetes version updates. And that's a problem because there's so many Kubernetes and you're upgrading your control plane. Every single scary is a good tool. So we haven't started using it yet. Can you guys hear me? It says my connection's unstable.
Yeah, you dropped out for a minute, but then just came back.
Okay, thanks. All right. Well, that's that announcement. Whatever I missed, you can catch from the README here. All right. Next announcement, last announcement I had is Ansible. If your shop's still using Ansible for some of your maybe legacy infrastructure, this might be a welcome addition, an official provider for Ansible deployments. Way back in the day, we wrote some Terraform module for this that just did a local exec. I think there's been a few attempts at providers for Ansible in the past. I don't think this was news to me, but this provider itself, based on the code history, is brand spanking new and released 1.0 just a couple days ago. All right. Any other announcements?
I'll just make a comment that I saw this and it seems like yet another thing we're shoehorning into Terraform because like technically, I mean, we don't really have the state of what's happening, right? We're basically just kicking off something else and telling it to work and like, then it goes and runs its thing. Like it doesn't actually know, you know, it's kind of like the curl provider that we saw. It's like, this is a state machine, right? Like, I should say this, Terraform is a state machine and we're basically kicking off things that have side effects to that state machine that we're not tracking, which seem kind of like anti-pattern of what Terraform's supposed to do in my perspective, but I mean, I guess I kind of get it, but it doesn't make sense. Like this is like deploying applications with Terraform is also not like a great thing to do, you know, either. Right. But anyway, that's my soapbox moment for a second.
So a few things, arguably, I mean, if Terraform had the state though, sufficiently passed from Ansible, any qualms then? I mean, that, you know, during plan phase, it gets everything that should happen. And during, you know, after
everything that happens. I mean, the problem is that even Ansible doesn't keep state, right? Ansible just runs a bunch of commands and everything that you kind of
You're describing something more like Salt Pillar, right? From Salt Stack, where the results are stored. And if they aren't what are expected, then scripts are rerun and there's like a back off to it and everything.
But Ansible doesn't have that, even if you're using Ansible power.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I got you. Okay.
It's just a playbook is just like a set of scripts that it runs and make sure that what you expect happened. And it kind of expects what you're doing to be idempotent so it can run it again, you know.
So now this does make me wonder if somebody's actually hacked a Salt Pillar to update like an S3 so that you can have your Salt Stack state in Terraform. That would be absolutely obscene and hilarious.
Yeah, although I mean it sets me off on a whole other tangent of why you don't want to be using Ansible, because you should be using versioned like idempotent architecture where you can, right? So if you need to make changes, I mean the argument could be made that in like making an AMI pipeline or, you know, something like that, you use Ansible to do provisioning inside like a pipeline. But once you build an artifact, it should be stable. You shouldn't be live updating your, you know, running instances with new patch versions and new versions of software and all of those things, because what ends up happening is 10 out of the 12 in your cluster succeed and then you get configuration drift and yada yada yada. We've had that call a whole bunch of that conversation a whole bunch of times. So I won't go off on that again. But anyway, it just seems anti-pattern of what Terraform is to me to use this. That was the main point I wanted to make without getting off on a huge tangent.
Yeah, understood. Well, any other announcements or additional announcements? Fun news, things you've come across? I'm always excited about new tools. All right, well, if no announcements, then let's just jump back into the Q&A. Any questions today? I don't believe there were any prepared questions in the Slack channel. Let me double check. Oh, Venkata asks a question for office hours. How do you folks track versions, package versions, as well as software licenses across repositories and languages? We are looking at creating a repository and doing this manually right now, but I have a feeling there's a better way of doing this. We are trying to ensure we keep our packages updated for CVEs and new features. And we always also wanted to make sure we're compliant with all the software licenses that we are using. So I think there's a few answers on this. I'll share what we're doing. Maybe Jeremy wants to share what he's doing with Nixos. Also helpful for context here, is this for like...
I think your screen isn't sharing properly, Eric.
Oh, I'm just reading it from the... I can share.
Yeah, I think the path you're about to go down is answering the wrong question, though.
It is? Okay.
Yeah, I think he's actually asking, how do you make a CMDB so that you have an accurate inventory of all of the packages and versions you're using across all of your applications, et cetera?
Gotcha. Yeah, thanks for catching me there.
It's called CMDB. Is that correct, Matt?
Oh, CMDB, a configuration management database. That's like the that's the industry term for kind of the thing that you're looking for.
Yeah.
It comes from like ITIL, definitions back in the day. That's kind of the whole thing. And at the risk of throwing Vlad into a tizzy here, maybe I'll say this is actually one of the things that Backstage does excel at. We talked, I think, a couple weeks ago about that and just all of the heavy lifting that there is to get it up and running for a lot of things. But it really does have a good ability to do that. The other place, if you're running all on AWS, that you could do this would be actually using AWS config to report on all the things that are running in your environment. And you pair that with System Manager, and they can actually give you a pretty good inventory of tons and tons of things that are running on all your apps.
Yeah, our primary use case right now is actually GitHub repositories, where all the source code is living. So I assume part of that would still apply, though. Being able to, I guess, introspect the package.json or the Terraform provider definitions, like just the different
the polyglot thing
using.
Yeah, I think you could certainly approach it that way, but it's probably a bit of a naive approach, mostly because of transitive dependencies. So you install a version of a package that installs a version of a package that installs a version of a package. And just by introspecting package.json, you have no idea that you're running some vulnerable package downstream by doing all this. It's like, you could certainly get some of that if it does that analysis and all the upstreams report properly what their vulnerabilities are, et cetera. But most of the successful versions of this I've seen do it at the like view your running code and decide, actually take inventory of what's running there and then do your CVE analysis based on that.
Got it. Yeah, I was thinking about that as well, the dependencies that you're referring to and whether or not it'd be taken on too much, but it does make sense. If you want the most accurate view, you'd want to go all the way down to those dependencies.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to manipulate the whole conversation monopolize the whole conversation there. If someone else has comments, please feel free.
All I can say is I've touched some of the different things for CVE management in the past, and all of them are usually in some way connected to MITRE, and all of them are very not free. So I can understand wanting to implement your own.
If you don't mind sharing, what was just one of them? Like, I haven't dug into the paid solutions yet. But if there's good or bad, it'd be good to know kind of like what's out there, I guess.
Well, I know one of them is gone now. So I can't really say much about that one, but I know it got, I think that the folks at Perch, actually, let me check that. I think it's Perch. I want to know because they're the ones who kind of came out of it. But long story short, there was some folks who went and took MITRE's taxi service system, which was a way of taking vulnerabilities and CVEs and everything else and kind of winding them into a stream of events, right? And you would let this sort of create queries against artifacts on your infrastructure. So this was actually kind of bigger, but at the same time included what you're talking about, right? So it would be something that you would take to their application at the time called Soltra. Now it's gone. But the application was running off of a MongoDB that had everything from IP addresses to software licenses and software versions and everything else. And it would just let you know, hey, here's stuff that right now is matching in your infrastructure. You might want to look at this. And it was pretty cool that, you know, like FireEye and a few other folks espoused it, liked it a lot. I used it. It was a little cumbersome to set up. I don't know how Perch is now or if Perch is still in business because, again, 2020 happened. I lost ties with those folks more around 2018. I was using this software back in 2015, just for full clarity. And, you know, I'd say, you know, at this point, I mean, I don't know, but it was pretty cool. You might see if there's still something there, or maybe even something open source. Sometimes well, that's what happens.
One of the tools that we brought up last week or the week before was this service called Steampipe. It's a open source platform, I believe. You can clone it, and it has plugins for all kinds of things. We haven't started using it, but it was recommended to me by one of our customers who was using it in a similar capacity. He was using it specifically to get versions of software installed on Kubernetes across all their clusters and being able to just do SQL queries for that. But just doing some, you know, armchair Googling here, it integrates with Trivy. And Trivy is a project by AquaSec or who was the company? AquaSec that is known for this and has this tool here, Trivy, which is also open source and apparently covers some of the things you're looking to do. So the combination of all of these three things gives you kind of a pluggable way to achieve what you're trying to do with an SQL interface that you could then report on or do anything else. I like that what intrigues me about it from a solution perspective is it's multiple birds with one stone. It's not just solving the problem you're trying to do, but if you also get this, you get all these other things at the same time.
Yeah, another vulnerability scanner that I can recommend out there that I've used before is Sonatype, like Sonatype Nexus. They have both an open source and a paid version of that.
And hey,
that are pretty
good. Can you take out my burrito for me while I'm in my meeting? Can you take out my burrito for me when it's done?
Somebody needs to mute, I think.
Thank you.
Hugo, you're not muted.
And now you got to share your burrito with everybody.
Something else to throw out there. If you do want to roll your own, things to keep in mind are like JOval, I think, is still a thing. I think that Microsoft has their own SIEM. Is that the acronym? I hate these acronyms.
That's different, though. That's
more security related, I think. Steam.
Well, okay. Yeah, but yeah. I my understanding is that a lot, those apps will take stock of software that's installed and let you know when OpenSSL, for instance, is a bad version, stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's tons of Steam platforms that are out there, and they range the gamut from being unusable and, you know, and to like needing entire teams to run them and be able to operate them and stay on top of them and, you know, and a bunch of other things. I think the biggest one is, what's that called? Wazuh. It's like W-A-Z-U-H or something. That's like an open, really big, like open source Seam platform out there.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's the OSEC Seam, yeah, because we use it. Yeah. We've got that actually running on our systems here.
This one in particular?
Yeah, Wazuh.
Hmm. This is cool.
I've never actually heard anyone pronounce it, I don't think. I've only seen it written, so I had no idea how to say it.
I would have pronounced it Wazuh as well.
Yeah. So I know it could do a lot, but it's, again, like, when you get into Seam platforms, the whole idea about them is that they take a lot of care and feeding to keep them up and running and getting you actionable advice out of them. They're never easy. I'll just say that. Like, no matter if it's open source or you pay, you know, $5 million for them, which I've worked at some large enterprises that have, you know, spent that kind of money, and they all seem to have the same level of complexity in my experience that you need a team that kind of stays on top of them to do that kind of stuff.
Very much. I mean, this the signal to noise ratio with the alerts and emails sent out of this when it was just stood up by the consultant team that did it was obnoxious. It ended up having basically heavy filter usage of email so that it, at that point nobody was seeing the messages.
It's the problem is it's a combination of a cultural problem and a compliance problem. Because like the reasons for, I mean, at least in my, you know, the area that I work, you know, I'm told, hey, some other organization, the ITO organization or whatever, is running Splunk, or, you know, whatever they're running for their Seam, and you have to ship your stuff over there, you know, but it's never like this for decently good reason. It's not like this is the exact stuff you're supposed to ship because it's different for everybody. But what people end up doing is just shipping everything, all their junk, everything, and just to check a box. But then like, what's the chances any of that is ever looked at ever? I think it's close to zero.
I think it depends on the organization. So like I'll just use my example of working with a very large enterprise that did this. They had a team that was dedicated to do that, and they actually told all the app teams to ship over like everything they could, you know, and every single message. And they just worked on like basically deciding what was interesting out of the streams of data that they got and making sure they alerted when they got those things. And that was that team's job. But it's like a full-time job to be constantly like tuning, you know, the entire giant metasphere of what's coming in to identify what's interesting and actionable out of that. And that was kind of what my point was, you know, at a top level, was like, you really have to spend a lot of time and effort to configure these things. And it's not a one-time set it and forget it and you're done. You have to be constantly staying on top of things and tuning and doing all that kind of stuff. So.
Yeah. When I asked this question, I was hoping the answer would be, here's a $10 a month service.
Yeah,
you know, it's never that easy. When you talk to us, it's never that easy.
It is. I think it is a two-headed problem, though. Maybe just to kind of give some closure, if you absolutely know what's going into your software, then you avoid having to passively scan it, right? Or you can always take the parts of your software that you aren't sure about and passively scan it. And if that's, you know, a few Docker containers that you just don't want to worry about too much, there you go. Oh, okay, this has an old version of BusyBox. Well, fine. You know, but I do think that maybe that's the nicer way to think about it, is that if you can come up with a solution that involves taking as much knowledge as you already have, whether you're using a Node.js app and you have your packages.json or stuff like that, just feeding in the basics that you can try to reduce the noise, that can make for something that's maybe a nicer hybrid approach. But again, I don't know the full scope necessarily of what you want to track.
I was actually just about to say that about SNCC too. Like you, if you look at, I think you have to look, the problem with security and, you know, and compliance at all of these levels is that there isn't a single point answer. It's a layered approach that you have to take to be able to meet what your goals are. And if you start with static analysis with SNCC, you're going to catch like a whole bunch of things before they ever get into your running environment, but that's not going to look at all the packages that you have running in your you know, in your actual environments and your OS level stuff. And you know, it's not going to catch, you know, your Datadog agent is running some downstream package that has a vulnerability in it, or you're not running the latest version of that, and you know, all of those kinds of things. So you really do have to take like a multi-layered approach in order to be able to at least do a decent job at this. And it's, I think someone else just wrote that there, Jonathan, just wrote, you know, security is expensive, and that's very true. It's expensive not only in like real dollars, because a lot of the tools are very expensive, but it's expensive in time and effort and, you know, and productivity, you know, everything else in your environment to get it right and to keep yourself non-vulnerable. So you asked a simple question that does not have a simple answer, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I appreciate all the context. I mean, having this discussion, there's a lot of things I wasn't thinking about. So definitely, I think we need to discuss on our end what we're trying to accomplish here with us, like how much of that do we want to cover, and know what those gaps are going to be if we decide not to do everything. And yeah, no, really appreciate the info as well as the recommendations here.
Yeah, also want to highlight the ones that Vlad brought up here in the Zoom chat as well. All right. Any other questions anyone has that we can help answer today?
Eric, this is Jonathan. I'd like to follow up with you on volunteering to help out with maintaining Bastion later on, if you have a chance. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, happy to entertain that. You're referring to the GitHub repo for Bastion. This was a project we started many, many years ago. It's kind of fallen out of disrepair, you could say.
Yeah, totally understand. It's a really useful tool. Still several hundred people still use it today.
Okay, that's good. Fun to hear. And I know it's still a very popular repository, ironically. So yeah, if you want to reach out to me, just eric@cloudposse.com, and we'll find a way to help make you a maintainer possibly on it. Do want to understand a little bit more about how you're using it, and you know, how you can contribute, what, you know, where you're at and so forth. But we are community supported, so if you can help, appreciate it.
Love to help with this one.
Cool.
I guess more of a question, kind of a question, I don't know if we answer here, but I had recently just noticed that the EKS, I'd missed the announcement that Windows was now a managed node group option. And I saw that the EKS node group module currently has a PR open, I believe it's PR 139, if I remember correctly, to add that support to the module.
Is it our EKS node group module? We have a few EKS like node
groups. The EKS node group, I believe it's pull request 139, I thought. Yeah, yep, right there.
Oh, yeah.
It's
a regular contributor. You know, it's again, if it's something you need, we can certainly look at it. Looks like there was a lot of chatter on this one. Post in the PR reviews channel is the best place.
Yeah, it's something that I was starting to work down developing my own module to support it. and then got sidetracked. And then when I went back to look at it, when we were doing our upgrades of the EKS cluster, I noticed that it was now an option. So looking to revisit it back and be able to add that into our Terraform.
Gotcha. Yeah, it looks like it just dropped off last week. Otherwise, it's ready for a re-review here. So yeah, we can certainly have somebody take a look at that again.
I'm actually curious why would one want to run a Windows EKS node?
We have a product team that they're trying to break up a Windows monolithic service into microservices and run it as EKS. So that's what they're currently running it as. They're currently doing it as a proof of concept, and we just kind of cobbled together a Windows node group using an auto scaling group and a template. But it's not as easy to manage as because we have to self-manage and do a lot of the care and feeding of the EKS configuration because it's not managed, so EKS doesn't handle it automatically.
I'm also doing a bunch of Windows on EKS, if it helps. Yeah, there are still a bunch of Windows apps out there that have to run. It's easier to run them in Kubernetes. And Fargate has support for Windows, but only for ECS. And you don't get all the features. Like a particular app that's a good example needs like a bunch of networking. We don't get that in Fargate. So we're running Kubernetes with Windows EC2 nodes. And it works pretty well. It's not perfect, but it works.
So the Docker, like a Docker image that runs Windows has to run on a Windows host. Is that the way that it works? Like I've actually never done it, so I'm just curious.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Okay. Yeah.
Got it.
You can't run a Windows Docker image on a Linux Docker node.
Got it. Yeah.
It also has to be from the same build version as well.
Correct. The Docker. And you still have to have the Linux node group because you still need, you can't have an EKS cluster that's strictly Windows. It has to have a Linux node group as well for the core DNS and the kubeproxy
and the controller like and all that. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So yeah, it's not completely Windows based.
Interesting. Yeah, I was just curious, like what the use case was because I hadn't done it myself. So thanks for educating me there.
So this is like to take a legacy app, host it, and then slowly move it to a .NET Linux version that you would eventually take off and get rid of that? Or are you guys, is that the goal I would say?
I don't know what the product team's plan as far as whether or not they're going to try and switch it over to be a .NET Linux application or not, or keep it on Windows. This is a product that was inherited and absorbed, and it's being maintained right now. It's a bunch of EC2 instances, and it gets out of hand trying to manage it.
The typical DevOps SRE life, huh?
Yep, very much so.
Awesome. So moving on, I guess, to the next questions. Any other questions we can help answer? Open mic, any other topics? Otherwise, I guess question I have, just based on some internal kind of lunch and learn we did last week, was on Nixos, or Nix, also the package manager. There's been, you know, more and more in my feeds about it. Mitchell Hashimoto has been a big proponent of it, he uses it for his local development. Curious from the group, who's using Nix here? Curious about it, or has any strong opinions against it? Just curious because our presentation internally was on maybe is there a world where geodesic or geodesic that we have today is offered alternatively as a Nix project? And you know, who would be excited if we had something like that? All right. I did see someone raise their hand. I think that was probably on another topic, maybe.
Yeah, separate topic.
All right. Well, it doesn't seem like there was any bites on this one. So, Darren, if you want to go on.
We're mainly a Python shop here. And the question earlier about CMDB kind of tangentially relates into something that I've been chewing around with is regarding like a dependency bot, but for PIP packages. I've seen dependency bots used quite frequently for NPM packages, but not for PIP packages as part of like maybe PIP compile. Has anyone used or seen a tool like that?
SNCC, that will definitely analyze all of your dependencies, both direct and transient, and tell you, you know, if there are any vulnerable ones that you're using.
Did you say SNCC, SNYK?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can put that right into your pipeline, like to do a, like right before you roll something out and have it do a scan and report and fail it or whatever.
Is this like a SAS tool or a like binary or?
Yeah, kind of all of the above. But if you want the real, what you want for production, it's a paid version that you use their service to do that.
There's like a GitHub Actions module that just plugs in.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And there's also
why CMI. Not Dependabot? Because Dependabot works for Python too.
Yeah. I thought we were asking for other alternatives other than the Dependabot. Maybe I misunderstood.
Yeah, I think I was just a bit ignorant. So thank you.
I'm sorry. But I thought you said you've seen Dependabot do it, but you were looking for alternatives.
It was a bit. Well, anyways, I'll try them both out. I would much prefer a paid feature because engineering 12.
Yeah, it's there are all those packages. So yeah, check out.
You can also, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, yeah, check out the links in the Zoom chat. We have all those.
Yeah, and I was gonna even mention that you can use CodeQL as well. That will actually scan your source code. To see if you're doing anything vulnerable in your source code, which is like a GitHub product now.
It was an acquisition they had, or where I don't know anything about CodeQL.
Yeah, it's basically you can run like basically there's CodeQL rules for all different things, and you basically can run like queries over your code to see if you're doing different things. Like you can look for like OS top 10 things that you might not be doing, and you know, a whole bunch of other interesting things. And there's built-in pipelines for most of the major languages, including Python.
All right, moving on. Next question or announcements, or just announced. Vlad, you shared something here.
Yeah.
Codex, the AI experiment. So to me, it was already AI. So can you help break down this announcement?
I've literally just seen this. Apparently, it's GitHub Copilot, but with ChatGPT, which is going to make it even dumber, but nice. I am still looking through the links. I pasted another one too. They also are experimenting with a bunch of things like GitHub. So there is GitHub Copilot Voice, which does, let me paste, get the link and paste it, which you can chat with your code. There's one for docs and one for pull requests. The pull request one was pasted, and let me paste the docs one. I don't know. I am not terribly excited of the latest trend of adding AI to every single thing, because, and I'm gonna leave it at that.
I don't care
about AI retelling me in English what my code does. That's like having a returned line of code and adding a comment before it returns result. Like, wow, yay, thanks, so helpful, fantastic AI, great help. It's the business context around the code, and it's the people context around the code, and AI doesn't have access to it, and adding all the AI to Copilot doesn't fill me with hope. But this may be just the crankiness, so I am open to trying the beta stuff in for preview or whatever.
I think this particular like announcement, one of the things that is different, so the original Copilot was built on the GPT-3 model, which was like, you know, there was a 3.5 and then 4, and you know, each of those was an exponential leap in productivity and number of parameters that they trained, you know, they trained the model on and everything else. So to be clear, this isn't changing to like a new ChatGPT version necessarily of it. They've always built it on the same GPT model because they've had a relationship with OpenAI for a really long time. So that's what the original Copilot was built on. So I think this is the core announcement of it moving to GPT-4 should make it like faster and more efficient at doing what Copilot always did. But the rest of the chat and voice and, you know, all that kind of stuff and pull requests and all that, I'm not commenting on those things, but at the core of the engine, I think we'll see significant improvement on speed and capability, because the models are like leaps and bounds better than one another as you move from 3 to 3.5 to 4.
I would also like to make a joke on top of that, which is I went over to a pull request and turned on the editor mode, which I don't know if folks are aware, but you can do by pressing period. And you still can't install Copilot into your GitHub pull requests, even though you can actually install the mutable AI Copilot alternative. And then have it comment on pull requests while you review them. So that's pretty funny.
Yeah, I'm excited about Copilot being able to generate my PR description for me and go through what changes I made and just summarize them in, you know, human readable type kind of bulleted list or whatever. That seems super valuable because I spend time doing that pretty frequently.
I think the what of what changed is really doable by AI, and it does a good job. The why it changed, you got to figure that one out on your own.
Mm-hmm. It'll be cool if it creates the PR that follows the contributing like requirements for some of the repos out there. I feel like some open source projects they deviate, and then now you have to like, you just want to make one simple change, but there's a huge
imagine updating your PR template to say Copilot : summary.
That'd be cool.
Like that would be amazing. A new person comes in, they don't have to worry about what your procedures are for, you know, creating a PR. It literally just goes through and does it all. That would be awesome.
Eric, didn't you link something earlier today? I forget if it was internal or on the SweetOps Slack, but some folks were using the GPT models to, you know, hey, given this code change, what's some good tests to run against this? And it was doing a decent job, apparently.
It was someone else on the team, but yeah. Matt, you were saying you did this, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So imagine if, you know, you make a pull request and just put in, you know, things to test.
Yeah.
And it just fills out a list of things to just be sanity checks that honestly, I don't see how that would be a problem. Like, I think that would be, at worst, there's some really dumb ones that are really quick to test.
A pre-commit hook or a GitHub action that automatically adds tests for any code that changes. All right. Any other announcements?
Oh, audio dropped out for a moment there for me too. Okay.
Yeah, you dropped, Eric, but you're back.
Okay, thanks. Yeah,
I think we got the gist of it. You were saying a pre-commit hook that would automatically run a test or write do a test for you.
Read my lips.
There you go.
When would you remember the test?
I couldn't hear Venkata. What was that?
I'm just thinking out loud. If you had a pre-commit hook that automatically added the test, at some point that code becomes legacy and you deprecate the need for that test. So I guess, would you have the AI automatically remove tests for you too?
I suppose, yeah. No simple problem.
Well, why even keep them necessarily? Especially if the AI can just generate them, then do you actually keep that code around, or do you get to this era now of a lot of code is just disposable one-time run?
Depends how much you trust the AI.
Yeah, exactly, to know what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you could potentially have those tests as a, I guess, second citizen, where you have your tests that you trust a lot more because they're written by developers, and then the ChatGPT or Copilot will create its own kind of AI tests and potentially identify issues.